Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the most important social, political, and cultural discussions taking place in America today? And what do our positions on the most contentious issues say about us as individuals and as a nation? Despite the old rule of etiquette to avoid discussing religion and politics in polite company, let alone sex, my guest today has quite literally made a career engaging in such discussions and gained a loyal following of readers drawn to his intrepid exploration of just the things that some find hard to talk about. Dan Savage writes the syndicated sex advice column Savage Love, and he is a regular contributor to This American Life. He is also the founder of the It Gets Better Project, designed to offer hope and acceptance to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender youth. His newest book is called American Savage: Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. And he joins us now from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Dan, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
Parents of young children, this is probably obvious already. We want to remind you that we will be referring to human sexuality throughout the hour. So if you don't want your kids to hear the conversation, now's the time to give them something else to do in the other room. That out of the way.
Ironically, it is those children who probably most need to hear this conversation are least likely to.
That is probably the case. So this is really interesting. You write that you were a member of this like model Catholic family growing up. And this is not just an expression. Your family was literally featured in a TV special about awesome Catholics.
That's right. The Catholic Television Network, which was a Chicago cable channel when I was a child. Who knows if that still exists anymore. My dad was a deacon and a Chicago cop. And my mom was only minister, and all four of their kids had been baptized in First Communion and confirmed. And I was in the seminary. And the Catholic Television Network did a little piece about us being the perfect Catholic family. And a few years later, my dad had divorced my mother and been defrocked. My mother was seeing someone else, inappropriately so. I had come out of the closet. My brother Billy, deciding he never wanted to have children, had gotten a vasectomy. There had been a couple of abortions in the family. So we went from being the perfect Catholic family to the actual, you know, real family. And we joked at that moment that they should do a Where Are They Now special, but they never did.
But your mother always maintained, I guess, a relationship to the church.
My mother was a devout Catholic until the day she died, mm-hmm. And a devout American Catholic, I call her in this book when I write about her. She believed that women should be ordained. She believed that the church should come around on birth control and gay people. And she didn't believe that blind obedience was something the church fathers or leaders, the hierarchy, could command of her. But she loved the church and believed that the church were the people in the pews as much as it was the priests and the bishops and the cardinals and the pope. And it's a particular kind of American Catholicism, and she exemplified it. I thought she exemplified the best of the social justice Catholic tradition. My mother was a Catholic in the Dorothy Day model.
Mm-hmm. Which is to say that human beings are deserving of rights and care and compassion, that sort of thing.
And love, mm-hmm. and support.
Yeah.
Yes, and you judge somebody based on their actions and whether they're hurting anyone. And if you're not hurting someone, you are not to be condemned.
So you have this great story about your mom going to her priest in real distress after you came out to her, worried about how she should handle this, about you. Tell us what happened.
I share this story when people, accuse me of hating people of faith or hating priests or hating the Catholic Church, because I credit this priest with really saving my life at this moment. I came out to my mom, and I was 17 or 18, and she wasn't she hadn't come around yet on gay people, and she called a priest, and because that's how Catholic we were. We had priests on call 24/7 who would come running to our house. And she called a priest, a friend, and he came to the house and sat with her on the porch. And she said, Danny said he's gay. And this priest, Father Tom, put his hand on my mother's knee and looked in her eyes and said, Judy, I'm gay. Hmm. And it's better this way. It's better for Danny to be out and to be telling you the truth now than to live as I have lived. And that was really a turning point for my mom, Tom coming out to her like that at that moment. And I get, I'm getting a little choked up thinking about it because I don't know. I didn't find out about it till years later. And I never got to thank Father Tom for that ministry, for what he did for me at that moment. because, you know, I was a vulnerable gay teenager, and LGBT kids are at 4 times greater risk of suicide when their families are hostile and homophobic, not, you know, violent, just hostile. Mm-hmm. LGBT kids are at 8 times greater risk of suicide. And at that moment, you know, my parents, my family could have gone one way or the other. They could have gone full bore, hostile, Catholic, reparative therapy, screaming and yelling, throwing me out of the house. Or they could have continued to, you know, love. And at that moment, my mother chose love because of Tom.
I want to talk about that, you know, part of your life, and then the It Gets Better project, which seems to have struck a chord for so many Americans, in part because of the very simplicity of the message. How did the particular phrase come to you?
I was writing about this kid, Billy Lucas, in Greensburg, Indiana, who, 15 years old, who killed himself, who was being brutally bullied and told to kill himself by his peers. And he may not have even been gay. He had never come out to anyone. Not all victims of anti-LGBT bullying are gay, but he was perceived to be gay and very brutally bullied. And he went home and hanged himself. And his mother found his body. And I was just really angry and writing about this from a place of rage. And somebody left a comment on my blog in the comment thread, cutting through everyone's rage. Everyone was just so furious and upset. And this commenter wrote, "I wished I'd known you, Billy, and been able to tell you that things get better. Rest in peace." And that just pierced me because, you know, I think in my own lifetime, just in my lifetime, when I came out to my parents when I was a teenager, telling my Catholic mom and dad I was gay meant that I would never marry, I would never have children, I could never be a Marine. And here we are just in one lifetime. And I have, you know, I'm married. I've been with the same guy for 18 years. We have a 15-year-old son that we adopted at birth. And now we can be Marines. We don't want to be Marines, but we could be Marines.
Yeah.
And things have really gotten better. But a lot of LGBT kids out there, particularly in the boonies, don't know it. And, you know, the feeling was, if I'd only been able to talk to this kid for 5 minutes and been able to tell him that things get better before he harmed himself, maybe it would have made a difference. And that was the genesis of the project, that we had this power now with YouTube and the internet and Twitter to bring to these LGBT kids and also straight kids who are being picked on because they're perceived to be LGBT, to bring to them the gay youth support group that doesn't exist in their community, or the gay youth support group that their parents would never allow them to attend. And we can put that support and perspective and advice on their phones and in their computers and get it into their schools. And this was really radical. Some people look at the project and see this sort of touchy-feely, up with people. They think it's really safe. And it's actually an act of pure cultural defiance, because what it says is these bullied LGBT kids, many of whom are being bullied by their own parents, by their preachers, by their teachers, not just their peers, we're going to talk to these kids whether you want us to or not. Game over. You know, we're not waiting for you to sign a permission slip to bring so this kid can go to the Gay Straight Student Alliance or come to an LGBT youth support group meeting. We're going to reach out to this kid using these new technologies. We're going to reach into your homes and talk to your bullied kids, whether you like it or not.
Well, and I always think about the kids who maybe no one knows yet that they are LGBT. They know, and they're sort of silently bullied. Like, they hear all this talk around them and all this really hateful speech. No one is picking on them. No one has sort of found them out, but they're still really damaged by this.
And they are really damaged by it. And in a way, you know, I was bullied in my middle school, not so much my high school. And in a way, I was sort of both those kids. Like, I was the bullied kid and the picked on kid, but I was also the kid flying under the radar in high school who wasn't picked on. And I was briefly suicidal, not when I was being bullied, but when I was flying under the radar and when I was being left alone. Because I thought for a while, based on things my parents had said to me or said to people while I was sitting there listening, that it would be easier for my parents to bury a child than have a child come out of the closet. Mm. And I thought, you know, I'm the good kid. I'm the good son. I never did anything wrong. And I love my parents and I would never want to disappoint them. So I should kill myself. Mm-hmm. And you may have a kid who is in every way the, you know, the all-American boy, the boy's boy. You may have a daughter who is in every way, you know, the girly girl. And you may not look at that boy or that girl and think they could be queer, but they could be queer. And they're listening to the things that you're saying. And you may instill such despair in your child. They're listening to things your pastor is saying. You may instill such despair in your gender-conforming, perfectly heterosexual-seeming child that your child kills himself or herself to spare you their coming out. That's what almost happened to my parents.
You know, the other thing, Dan, about this whole campaign that makes it brilliant is that today, I think anybody would look at you and think, and if they didn't know your story, think, well, here's a guy who is really self-confident. He's proud. He's got this perfect life. He never struggled. And it's great to sort of see adults who look like they have it all together today saying, I know what you've gone through.
That's hugely important, you know, and the research shows that that's true, that there are LGBT, it used to be that you could grow up gay thinking you were the only gay person on the planet.
Yeah.
Nobody grows up that way anymore. People who are young and gay, they know that there are gay adults in the world, whether it's just they know about Ellen and Neil Patrick Harris. They just know that there are gay people in the world who are happy and loved and successful, but they don't know how you get to be one. And they may assume that if you're, you know, me, if they've heard of me or a Tim Gunn or an Ellen, that you couldn't have suffered the way they are suffering or you wouldn't have made it. Hmm. And you wouldn't be happy. You know, a lot of LGBT kids who do harm themselves, they look at life and they think nothing will ever compensate. You know, there's not enough joy coming my way to compensate for the pain I'm in right now. And our lives as adult LGBT people can prove that joy is coming their way if they can get through these low moments. Which Terry, in the first It Gets Better video, the one that we created when we launched the project, really exemplified. You know, I was picked on, I was bullied. Terry was brutalized and terrorized growing up in Spokane, Washington, and being pretty gay. And just what he was put through was unspeakable. And he has a wonderful life, and he has a wonderful family, and he's happy. And he has the love and support of not just his own family, but my family and all of our friends. And he's a wonderful, terrific human being now. And for kids to know that, you know, you can get through something as awful as Terry was put through and life can still come together for you in a wonderful way is hugely important. You know, especially kids who don't have LGBT role models in their lives, who don't have teachers at their schools who can be out. They have gay teachers at their schools. Just many kids don't know that they have gay teachers at their schools. They need to see the truth and reality of gay and lesbian, bi and trans folks' lives so that they know that their life isn't always going to be middle school.
You you mentioned that you guys have been together for 18 years. Years before, you were actually allowed to be legally married first in Canada and then in Washington State. Did things feel different for you in your relationship after the ceremony sort of made it official?
You know, it's funny. Terry got in trouble on the blogs a little bit ago because he said marriage didn't make us feel any different. You know, it didn't change. And what he meant is it didn't change our feelings for each other, our love for each other, which was always very powerful. I feel that marriage does make you move differently through the world. We feel more fully empowered as citizens in Washington State, not federally, not yet. Here's hoping the Supreme Court overturns DOMA in the next couple of weeks. But I do feel like socially and that public acknowledgement and affirmation is hugely important. And it just doesn't send a message to the individual couples that marry, but to the society and to other queer kids out there and straight kids out there. That we exist and that we are equal under the law and entitled to the same rights and responsibilities as any other individual or couple. And that has a real impact. It had an impact on our son. You know, it's funny for me as a gay person and a grown up and an adult when I hear people who oppose same-sex marriage say that what they really oppose is same-sex couples parenting, because there's nothing, we were parenting for a decade before we could get married, that there's nothing to stop gay or lesbian couples that wish to have children from having children. Preventing us from marrying doesn't stop us from starting families. It just leaves our families in a more vulnerable position.
Dan Savage is with us. He writes the syndicated sex advice column, Savage Love, and he's a regular contributor to This American Life. His new book is called American Savage, Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Yeah. funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We have writer Dan Savage with us today from the studios of KUOW. He's a regular contributor to This American Life and author of the advice column Savage Love. His new book is called American Savage: Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Dan, as you well know, and you mentioned this earlier, you know, there's nothing in the law to stop gay and lesbian adults from becoming parents. But, of course, many people object to the idea that somehow for the good of the children, this will affect them. You know, a child growing up with same-sex parents somehow will be subject to being teased or will be confused. Your son seems to have done just fine. And you write about him coming out to you as straight when he was 11.
The first point I want to make is people made that exact same argument, and I remember people making that argument. I remember hearing from my relatives when I was a child about interracial couples and their children. Hmm. And now we have a president of the United States who is the product of an interracial relationship.
He's done okay for himself.
Yeah, he's done okay for himself. And his children will benefit, right, from, you know, their father's success. So this argument that, you know, think of the children is just kind of bait and switch. The children of LGBT parents may be picked on. Children may be picked on for their race, their religion, other factors that are outside of their control. And we don't turn around and say, well, you know, you probably, you know, if you didn't want your kids picked on for being the only Jewish kids in the neighborhood, you should have had them baptized.
Yeah.
We don't say that to Jewish families and Jewish parents. We say, wow, anti-Semitism is a terrible thing and a real problem, and we're going to fight that, and there's nothing wrong with you or your family. And we should say the same thing to children who have same-sex parents. You know, our son is 15. One of the arguments against same-sex parenting is that children will grow up to be gay, that they will adopt their parents' sexuality. If that were true, there would be no gay children. There would be no gay adults.
Right, because they
were straight.
Born of straight parents, right.
Right. My parents were straight, and that parents, kid children always adopt their parents' sexuality thing. Clearly it didn't work on me or Terry, who has straight parents. Mm-hmm. And our son is 15 and is openly straight. And I think if, you know, parents being gay made you you gay, we're super gays, me and Terry. and it clearly didn't impact DJ's authentic and natural and inborn sexuality at all, not one iota. He is a super straight kid, and he's a great kid and a nice kid. Mm-hmm. He's an adolescent. We're having teen drama like other parents do, of course. Mm-hmm. But we're getting through it as a family, and he just finished his first year of high school and did okay. And we're looking forward to meeting the adult he's going to be on the other side of adolescence, as all parents, I think, of 15-year-olds feel.
You also take on here this stereotype that people have that mothers make their sons gay by being too close to them. And your perspective on this is that it's people have it upside down.
They do have it upside down. It's not that, you know, I had a really tight relationship with my mom and a really distant relationship with my father. And a lot of people on the religious right look at that and diagnose and say, ah, that is what causes homosexuality. No, that is caused by homosexuality. My dad and I grew estranged as I when I was a child because he could perceive that I was gay and he disapproved. And it led to me withdrawing from him and him sort of withdrawing from me. And the homosexuality, you know, they call it pre-homosexuality in prepubescent children, it led to the estrangement. It wasn't created by the estrangement. And I was tight with my mom because I was kind of girly and I wanted to, you know, hang out with her when she was with her lady friends having coffee clutches. And I was more interested in girl things than boy things. And my mom was a girl. And that wasn't what induced my homosexuality. That was a consequence of my being a gay child.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go first on the phone to Jason in Dallas. Hey, Jason.
Hi. How's it going?
Great. Thank you.
Hey, I had a question. So when you sort of enter into a dialogue with, you know, an individual or a group or whomever that's so starkly opposed to homosexuality or, you know, the LGBT lifestyle or whatever, how do you sort of enter into conversation with them? Do you approach them in their own like context, whether it be theological or cultural, or how would you suggest, or what do you think about, you know, sort of engaging in conversation, and how do you address them culturally?
I do engage in those conversations. It's important when people say they're opposed to the LGBT lifestyle to draw them out and lay at their feet that what they're opposed to is LGBT existence, that they wish we weren't here. And that's not an option. We're not going anywhere. We're not all going back into the closet. We have always existed, and we will continue to exist. So let's take that off the table. And, you know, your opposition to the lifestyle isn't preventing me from going home to my husband's tonight. So where is it getting you? I do, however, sometimes feel an argument with somebody who is really very, very committed to their anti-gay bigotry, that that argument isn't for that person. That, you know, like Brian Brown, the head of the National Organization for Marriage, came over to my house for dinner so we could have a dinner table debate about gay people and about the Bible. I wasn't going to convince him. He wasn't going to convince me. We were both speaking to and engaging with each other and civilly. But we were talking to the persuadables, the people on the margins, people who might be tuning in because they want more information. That's often what goes on when people who are antis on either side of this issue or on either side of this issue talk. When I talk to people who are, you know, just personally and one-on-one who have a theological problem with gay people, I'm willing to say to them, and I often do, and it can really help for them to hear, you don't have to change your theology. You can still think that I am going to hell with the Jews and the yoga instructors and the atheists and the Buddhists and sign off on my full civil equality. You know, you're not out there actively trying to persecute adulterers or people who are getting divorced and remarried, all of which both of things are condemned in explicit terms by the Bible. Jesus condemns adultery in the Bible and never gets around to condemning homosexuality. And you live in a society, you tolerate divorce, legal divorce. You tolerate remarriage. You tolerate people of other faiths or people of no faith who your faith tells you are damned to hell, like I am. You can tolerate me too, and you don't have to change your religious beliefs one bit to tolerate me and even support my rights as an equal citizen under the law. And sometimes saying that to someone who has a theological problem or a religious problem with gay people or lesbian or bi or trans people in our existences and our lives can really help them kind of break through their opposition to our legal status, to, you know, our enjoying the same legal rights as everyone else. Because you don't have to, you can support gay marriage and think it's wrong. You can support legal divorce, and people do, and still think it's wrong.
Well, drill down on this a little more for us, Dan, because why, when this is not like if you look at the Bible, proscriptions against homosexuality are hardly an overwhelming theme. Why do we not have like anti-adultery organizations? And what is it about lesbians and gays that causes a lot of people of faith to feel like it's a major problem for society, for morality, that sort of thing?
Well, here's the thing. it costs you nothing to oppose. If you're a straight person, it costs you nothing. You don't have to make any sacrifices to oppose the rights of gays and lesbians. And you can feel morally superior and right with God and not have to change your own behaviors one bit. That's a lot of what's going on with opposition to gay people. You know, there's social anxiety about divorce rates, about unwed, you know, people having children out of wedlock. And there's this great transference projection, you know, and this desire to say, well, the problem here are gay people who, you know, up until this moment weren't getting married and divorced at all and never have an unplanned pregnancy. But the problem is them. And it's really just easy grace or cheap grace. I've heard it's, you know, is one way it's been used to describe it, that I can achieve cheap grace with God, not by changing my behavior, not by hewing to what the Bible says about heterosexuality. There are a lot more. The Bible has a lot more to say about heterosexuals and the way they should behave. But by focusing and obsessing about these things that impact me, not at all.
Does being a professional dispenser of sex advice make it simple and comfortable to talk to your own child about sex?
No, not at all. I think it's always awkward, parents talking to children. It's especially awkward for my kid.
Yeah.
Because you know, he doesn't want to talk about sex with us or with me any more than I wanted to hear about sex from my parents. Mm-hmm. I am so tuned in and tapped into everything that can possibly go wrong, because I get letters about it every day, that I've, you know, had to speak to DJ at great length about things I think he needs to be aware of if and when he chooses to become sexually active. The trick is, and my advice to other parents out there who might be listening, is it's not a conversation you're going to have with your child. It is a monologue. You're going to sit with your child and you're going to run your mouth. You go in, make some notes, go in with the points you want to cover, the info you think your child needs. And don't have a dialogue, because your kid is going to ask no questions or as few as possible to make this stop.
Right. The whole I got it, Mom. I got it, Dad.
Exactly. Right. And yeah. So what I've said to DJ when we had those conversations is, I know this is killing you. I know you want me to stop. I'm going to run through this information with you. The more you object, the longer this is going to take to talk through. And so here we go. And here's what you need to know about birth control. And here's what you need to know about sexual assault and consent and boys and girls, and here's what you need to know about X, Y, and Z, and here's everything that you need to know. And it was several conversations where I was just, here's the download, and I know you're hating this, and I'm hating that you're hating this, and we're both mortified. Let's get it over with.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to not do it. I'm not going to wish I had talked to you about these things when you come home to tell me at 16 that your girlfriend's pregnant.
Yeah. Well, knowing that a lot of parents don't have these conversations with their kids, you are a staunch opponent of abstinence-only sex education. What do we know about the STD rates, the unintended pregnancy rates among teenagers who have been taught this way exclusively?
We know that they're higher. The abstinence-only crowd likes to point out that kids who've had abstinence-only education delay the onset of sexual activity. That's, I think, the phrase that's sometimes used in the research. But they don't go on to point out that they don't delay it until marriage, which is what they're taught in abstinence only. The delay is about 6 months on average. A kid who's had abstinence only sex education on average becomes sexually active 6 months later than a kid who's had comprehensive sex education. But that kid who's had abstinence only and nothing else is, when he or she becomes sexually active, likelier to contract a sexually transmitted infection and likelier to get or impregnate somebody else, to get pregnant or impregnate someone. So as a strategy to keep your kids safe, it's pretty ineffective. It's pretty counterproductive. If what you want to do is keep your kid from having an unplanned pregnancy or contracting an STI, this you don't want. You don't want abstinence-only sex ed. You want comprehensive, realistic sex ed, which you really don't have in many places. I write about this at great length in one of the chapters in the book. We don't teach pleasure, and pleasure is 99.99% of the reason that people have sex. Most of the time when people are being sexually active, they're not trying to make a baby. Human beings, by design, you know, we have female humans don't go into heat. By design, we have concealed ovulation.
Mm-hmm.
On average, 1,000 sexual acts for every live birth. Human sexuality is about intimacy. It's about connection. It's about release. It's about pleasure. It's about a partner bond. And every once in a great while, it's about making a baby. But all we talk about in sex ed is that making of the baby. And we don't talk about pleasure. We don't talk about consent. We don't talk about why people are actually having sex.
Well, is it the idea, do you think, Dan, that we say, if we tell kids, yeah, it's fun and it feels great, then they're just going to have no self-control?
No, I don't think that's going to happen.
No, I mean, is that the fear?
That is the fear. And there's a study out of the UK that showed that the opposite, what happens when you build sex ed with, you know, that's shaped and warped by that fear, that they did all this research and kids were having sex. They were still sexually active, but they're engaging in sex acts that were unpleasurable and painful because they didn't know sex was supposed to feel good. They're having sex with partners who were abusive. They were having sex with partners who didn't care about their pleasure or comfort, and they had no idea that there was something wrong with that, because nothing in the sex ed that they had covered pleasure or even acknowledged pleasure as a paramount aspect of human sexuality and expression.
What kind of sex ed did you get as a kid?
You know, it's funny. I had sex ed in fourth grade in my Catholic school in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
We have become much more sexually conservative about what we talk to and speak with children about. The sex ed I got in fourth grade at St. Ignatius on the north side of Chicago was more comprehensive than the sex ed that a lot of kids in Texas get now in high school.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's speak next on the phone to Anne in Dallas. Hey, Anne.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I totally respect your views on your book. I'm so glad you guys are having this conversation. My question is two questions. Is balance. Often when I'm such a people person and I'm so in tune to how people think and their views and how they shape and mold their lives. But one of my concerns is balance. How do we find, like, do I miss, what is it that if I don't completely agree with you, I'm a bully or I'm bashing you? And two, that's my first question, do we have to agree to respect each other? Can I disagree with you and still have respect for you? That's one. And then two is sometimes I feel like I miss the opportunity to know a person because everything is, I'm gay. That's like my first handoff. And I'm just like, I just want to know your name. I mean, you know, where are you from? What do you do? Why is that such the lead? I know that the opposition and the world coming around to the lifestyle has been a struggle, but sometimes it overshadows just a person being a person.
Well, let's get some answers. What do you think, Dan?
Well, starting with the last comment or the last observation, you know, why do gay people bring up the fact that we're gay? Well, heterosexuality is assumed. You don't have to bring up the fact that you're straight when you meet somebody because you default to straight, that we have to self-assert. Otherwise, we will be perceived to be straight when we are not. So you're kind of letting someone believe a lie about you unless you say you're gay. And that sometimes leads people to believe that we're making such a huge issue about our homosexuality. We're not making a huge – we wish we didn't have to make an issue out of us being gay. People who, you know, the culture, the society that persecutes and marginalizes us and discriminates against us under the law, that's what made an issue out of being gay. Gay would not matter at all if we didn't have to fight for the right to marry, fight for the right to protect our families, fight for the right to, you know, not be fired or thrown out of our apartments or denied services in a public and public accommodations like other minority groups. Straight people made gay a huge issue by persecuting gay people, not the other way around. And I can't remember the first two questions.
She was asking about whether she could disagree with you and still be perceived to have respect for you.
Oh, absolutely. You know, in 2008, I disagreed very passionately with President Obama about his position on marriage, and I wrote him a check and I voted for him. So gay people aren't looking for everyone to be on our side 100% of the time on all issues. Not even all gay people agree with each other 100% of the time on everything, not even about marriage. So we can certainly agree to disagree, but I hope that we can all get to a point where even if you disagree, you can support our full civil equality.
My guest is Dan Savage. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dan Savage. He writes the syndicated sex advice column Savage Love, and he's a regular contributor to This American Life. He's got a new book out as well. It's called American Savage: Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Dan, when you first started writing your column, were there editors and people who were concerned that straight people wouldn't take sex advice from a gay guy?
Yeah, there were. I was one of them.
Really?
I first started writing the column, the idea was it was a joke. I was going to write a column as a gay man giving sex and relationship advice to straight people. And I was going to treat straight relationships and straight sex with the same contempt and revulsion that so many straight advice columnists had always treated gay people and gay sex with. And I was going to be very abusive and dismissive and treat straight people with contempt. And it was going to be a joke, and I was going to do it for, you know, 6 months or a year and then go back to my regular life. And it turned out that straight people loved this, that this was a new experience for them being treated with this kind of contempt. They had never been subject to this before. And the mail just started pouring in and the questions. And that's really, you know, that's really what validates an advice column and an advice giver is people ask. They read your advice and they think, oh, I want to ask this person for help or this person for their POV on my problems. And it just took off and kind of ate my life. And 22 years later, I'm still doing it.
You do say, though, that there is, you know, a lot of times people who are invested in equality for LGBT Americans want to say that there is no difference whatsoever to relationships. And you point out that sexually there are some differences between the average gay relationship and the average straight relationship.
It's true. You know, men and women are different in ways. And there are endless arguments, and I don't think we'll ever be done with them, about whether this is biological, genetic, or cultural. And I think it's some combo platter of all of that. But one example is the couples out there, committed loving couples, least likely to be monogamous, gay male couples. More likely to be monogamous, straight couples. Most likely to be monogamous, lesbian couples. Hmm. So it tells you that not something about gay men, but something about gay men, that men are different in some ways than women, whether it's biological, cultural, men are different. So when you have a culture that's all male or a culture that's all female, it's going to be different than a culture of a sex culture that is male and female. And there are upsides and downsides. A lot of studies that show that same-sex couples in long-term relationships report higher levels of satisfaction in those relationships. And also have more egalitarian relationships, because there's no sort of defaulting to or expectation of gendered behaviors, that you get to write your own ticket. You get to negotiate everything and talk everything out in a same-sex relationship in ways that you can in a straight one, but you don't have to. And many straight couples don't.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Lisa in Fort Worth. Hey, Lisa.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Okay. I was wondering, you commented earlier how when you and your partner were married in Washington, how it made you feel differently, you know, emotionally and psychologically. And I've just moved to Texas from the Northeast, where, you know, in a state where they had equality in marriage. And what I noticed in the Northeast is it also kind of affects everyone psychologically. Like, straight people, or I don't know, just people you meet, are more likely to be like, you know, oh, you have a wife. Wow. Well, great. Congratulations. And I wondered what your take was on how it affects the culture in general, not just your own personal, emotional, and psychological views.
Well, I do think it sends a message throughout a state or a community or a region, as in the Northeast, where marriage equality is basically the land of New England, or the law all over New England. As it sends a message that, you know, these people are equal and should be treated equally and treated with respect. Like, the state is saying these relationships are worthy of respect and enjoy the same kind of privilege that other relationships do. And that does have kind of a ripple effect, and that can change people's hearts and POVs. Jumping back for a second to one of the previous callers, says, well, you know, can we, you know, what about if we disagree? And one of the points I always like to make, you know, for people who fear the coming of marriage equality, lest they be stigmatized, is we can tolerate people who are all over the map. We, you know, currently people tolerate folks who disapprove of interracial marriages or folks who disapprove of interfaith marriages. And certainly same-sex couples and gay people in the queer community, we can tolerate people who disapprove of our relationships and our sexualities. What we can't tolerate is the status quo. We're not fighting to change everyone's minds or to change anyone's religion. We're fighting to change the law. And once that's changed, we're done. And you can go on believing that gay marriage is wrong or that same-sex relationships are wrong, but you just can't insist that your private, perhaps religious beliefs be given the force of law in a secular, pluralistic democracy. That we're not willing to tolerate. The status quo, which amounts to, you know, this just happened, a gay man married to his male partner being dragged from his partner's hospital room in handcuffs when the staff called the police because they refused to recognize their relationship. Those are the injustices that we are not willing to tolerate. That is the status quo right now. We're not willing to tolerate that. Your private religious beliefs, absolutely 100% willing to tolerate.
How much of a lag do you think there is between changing the law and an overall cultural acceptance of a particular phenomenon, be it full rights for people based on race or on gender preference, that sort of thing?
Well, we have a perfect model in the interracial marriage issue. When the Supreme Court in Loving v. Virginia imposed or legalized interracial marriage in all states, something like 75-80% of the country was opposed to interracial relationships.
That was like mid-60s, right? Late 60s?
Yeah, late 60s. or early 60s. And now, you know, 40 years later, one or two generations of marriage and families being created and people getting to meet and know interracial couples and meet their children and vote for their children as president of the United States, the polling is flipped. It's like 20% opposed interracial relationships. I think we're going to see the same thing on same-sex relationships. We're already over 50% support for the rights of same-sex couples. And some of that support is from people who, like I keep pointing out, believe that you know, their faith teaches them that it is wrong, but they believe everyone should be equal under the law. And I think it'll take a generation or two before we get to the kind of support for same-sex relationships that you see for interracial relationships, but we will get there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Todd on the line in Dallas. Hi, Todd.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say I agree with 99% of what he's saying, but I love to play devil's advocate, so I want to ask this question. And by the way, I'm an atheist. If Congress made a deal with the community and said you could have everything that the married couples have except you have to call it a civil union, would that be acceptable? And by the way, I'm against government-sanctioned marriage, period, whether it's gay or straight.
That's what they did in the United Kingdom. That's what they did in Vermont. That's what we did here in Washington State. We had all the rights the state could confer, but it wasn't marriage. And that sends a message that these couples are lesser than, not entitled to, somehow a threat to this other institution. And everywhere, you know, where they call it civil partnerships in the UK, where it's been rolled out, it becomes this gradual sort of acclimation process where people get used to the idea of couples who are legally equal, you know, but they're not allowed to say the magic two-syllable word marriage at their ceremonies. And, you know, I think it's a stopgap measure. I think it's better to treat all couples equally than to create parallel institutions. And some people who worry about undermining marriage for straight people by allowing same-sex couples to marry, they created in France, which now has marriage equality, they created in France a lesser thing for gay people, like a little marriage light to protect marriage from same-sex couples. And what happened was a lot of straight couples opted for this marriage light, and people were getting marriage light instead of married. And this effort to wall gay people off from marriage actually undermined straight marriage in the process, which is one of the reasons France opted then to just make all couples equal under the law as they have now.
Of course, France is still struggling with the question of whether same-sex couples make good parents. It's odd that we are sort of in different places on this issue.
It is. In the United States, paradoxically, and I read about this at great length in my book, paradoxically, you know, we sort of treat parents as autonomous. People can have children however they want to here. In other countries, there are stiff regulations, much stiffer on IVF treatments, on adoption than there are here. And so in countries like Belgium, they legalized same-sex marriage, but they didn't legalize gay people adopting or becoming parents or having IVF treatments through the state healthcare system. In the United States, in a lot of places, gay people were already parents, already having children, but they weren't married. And so we've kind of done the opposite of the way a lot of liberal European countries have done it, where we had parenthood first and then we had gay marriage. We had gay parents first, then gay marriage. And in a lot of countries in Europe, they had gay marriage first, and now they're legalizing same-sex couples adopting or having their own children. And all the research, all the data, save one deeply flawed and discredited report out of Texas, show that same-sex parents are just as good, just as fit. Our children are just as happy, just as healthy. Sometimes those studies show our children are happier and healthier, and that's not because we're magic, and it's not because we are superior in any way as parents. It's just the difference for us is we don't have children by accident. You cannot get drunk and adopt one night. And a wanted child is a child that is going to be, you know, prepared for. The parents will be ready. And that can make all the difference. And, you know, in most cases, straight people have wanted children, but in some they don't. And most, you know, my parents, when they first got married, it was because they had to. And so, you know, but they rose to that challenge and they were terrific, wonderful and loving parents. But sometimes, as the data shows, people who did not want children and weren't ready for it don't make very good parents. And those parents invariably are straight.
We have an email here from Jessica in Dallas who says, I'm a high school teacher and was thinking about starting an LGBT club at school. I'm a heterosexual female but have many lesbian and gay friends. I see a need for support at my school for LGBT students. Is there somewhere I might go to get information to start a club like this?
you go to GLSEN, the Gay Lesbian Education Network. It's GLSEN.org. And they have all the information that you would need about starting a gay straight alliance at your school. That's what they're called, gay straight alliances, not LGBT clubs. And they're open to all students, including straight kids who are allies of LGBT kids. They're not, as some religious conservatives have described them, sex clubs that meet in high schools and middle schools. They are a space where kids who are LGBT or straight can sit and talk and meet and socialize and decompress in an environment that is affirming and supportive. And they're really important. They really can change the dynamics in a school. And if you teach at a public school, the law, federal law, says you cannot block the formation of a GSA. It is illegal. And so if you go to GLSEN and you get the info that you need about starting a GSA and your school board or your school administrator shoot it down, then you go to the ACLU and they will sue your school if they attempt to shut down a GSA, because that is against the law, federal law. And that law was actually drafted to protect religious groups in schools, in public schools and middle schools. So that law protects not just the rights of the gay, lesbian kids and their straight allies, many of whom are children of faith, from having a GSA. It's also that law exists to protect kids who want to start a Bible study class or club in their school from being discriminated against.
How important in the culture of a school is the presence in those gay straight alliances of, like, cool students who happen to be straight?
It's hugely important, you know, particularly for a gay kid who's been bullied all too often. This was the case for me. When I was in school, I thought, oh, my God, I hate straight people.
Because they felt like, you know, a threat to you.
Yeah, and they were mean to me. Mm-hmm. And it took me some time to realize that it was just a tiny little percentage of straight people who were awful, and that most straight people were actually really wonderful. And, you know, some of my best friends are straight people. And so for there to be straight kids who are willing to, you know, expend a little social capital by being members of the GSA and linking arms with the gay kids and saying I'm on their side and they shouldn't be discriminated against or bullied or picked on, that's hugely important. Even to the gay kids who aren't out in your school, who don't go to the GSA meetings, just to know the GSA is meeting and that there are gay kids and straight kids in that room who support each other can make all the difference, can give that kid who's not out yet the hope that they need to hang in there.
How optimistic are you about these two upcoming Supreme Court decisions?
I think we're going to hopefully, knock on wood, I'm Catholic, and you know you're not allowed to say a good thing is going to happen because then God will hear you and make the opposite happen. I'm confident based on all the writing and the arguments that we may see a good decision on DOMA repealing the Defense of Marriage Act, which would then mean that same-sex couples like my husband and I in Washington State, that we would then now have also federal recognition for our marriage, not just state. Mm-hmm. Like Social Security benefits and survivor benefits and the other 1,100 incidents of marriage that come from the federal government. But then that wouldn't help couples in other states. That's Prop 8. I think the Supreme Court's going to punt on Prop 8. What people are saying is we're not going to see a Roe v. Wade on marriage. We're not going to see the Supreme Court impose marriage on Texas and Mississippi and Alabama with their Prop 8 ruling. They're likely to leave that aside for now, legalize marriage at the federal level for couples in states where marriage is legal, and then allow the democratic process to continue to work.
Dan Savage's new book is called American Savage: Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. Dan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really loved it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance from Lindsay Kinect, Joe Bellotti on the phones, and Christine McConnell producing the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.